We're on. Okay. Well, welcome, Truth Seekers. This is the Mike Malloy Program. Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy all week long. Don't sweat it, Tony. It happens. We're broadcasting live out of Los Angeles, Hollywood, Burbank, beautiful downtown Burbank at K-Talk AM 1150. Yeah, we had a bit of a panic getting on the air. That's par for the course. Anyway, I'm Brad Friedman in for Mike Malloy all week long. Brad Friedman, that guy from bradblog.com. Yes, that's right. Your friendly sit-in investigative journalist blogger. Yeah, I'm back. Get over it. You can stop on by Bradblog, the open thread there at bradblog.com. I'm going to do my best to keep an eye on that once we get caught up with a few technical issues over here for a change, right? Whenever I go on the radio, it's, you know, I'm poison. Radio poison. And welcome to it. We got a big show ahead for you. Don't worry, this will all smooth out. We got a big show ahead for you, and we will take your calls at 877-520-1150. I got to repeat that a few times because it is not Malloy's normal number. If you call over there, I don't know what you'll get. Maybe Mike and Kathy down in Florida, wherever they are. So give us a call here, 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. Coming up on the show today, big show. Stephen Zunis is going to be joining us at the bottom of this hour to talk about the latest in Iran. Eric Bullard from MediaMatters.org is going to be joining us. He's got a new book out, Bloggers on the Bus. It's about the 2008 election and the effect that bloggers had. Guess what? I'm not in it. I don't know how that happened. Don't laugh, Desi. I don't know why I'm not in that book. So we're going to find out about that. Later on, we're going to have Mimi Kennedy joining us. Mimi Kennedy, the advisory chair of Progressive Democrats of America. She is also perhaps better known to you as Dharma's mom from Dharma and Greg. She has a new movie out called In the Loop, which I saw over the weekend. It is really good. It is really funny. It's a political dark satire, I guess. Black comedy, is that what we call it? She's going to be here in studio. That's right. I told you, we're in Hollywood. And also going to be joined later in the show by Marcy Winograd, who is a progressive Democrat. Yeah, a real one. You remember progressives, right? Who's running against in the primary next year against Jane Harman. The beleaguered Jane Harman, the Jane Harman who was heard on wiretaps working out a quid pro quo with a guy from AIPAC trying to promise to help get the AIPAC indictments dismissed from the Department of Justice or something. And by the way, they were dismissed. I'm sure Jane Harman had nothing to do with it. Marcy ran against her, 2 years ago, did not win in the primary. She's going to take another run at it, and not a moment too soon, says me, because I think we could use some more progressives out there. Maybe that's just me. No, it's not just me. It's a lot of people, including Bill Maher over the weekend. I don't know if you heard that. We ran the video at Brad Blog. We might play it later in the show if we can have time. Maher said, what was it that he said? He said, the Democrats have, we don't have two parties in this country. We've got only one, because the Democrats have moved to the middle, to the right, to the center-right, and the right has moved to the insane asylum. He has. You been watching Fox lately? It's crazy land over there. Yeah, we'll talk to Bullard about that in a bit. Anyway, some breaking news. Got a lot going on today. Breaking news right now in D.C. Six now dead in the Washington area. Metro train collision during rush hour there today. Two metro trains north of downtown D.C. killed at least six people right now. Another nine injured. It's a mess. The crash occurred just before 5 p.m. on the busy rush hour commute there on the above-ground track on the Red Line near Tacoma Park, Maryland, according to D.C. Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. At least nine people have been hurt. We will be keeping our eye on that. Not good. Other news today. Some stuff out of the Supreme Court. And frankly, well, one good, one bad. The Supreme Court will not revive a lawsuit that former CIA operative Valerie Plame brought against former members of the Bush administration. The court on Monday refused to hear an appeal from Plame and her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, A lower court last year had thrown out the lawsuit in which Plamen Wilson accused former Vice President Dick Cheney and several former high-ranking administration officials of revealing her identity to reporters in 2003. Plamen Wilson said that violated their constitutional rights. Yeah, it did. It violated my constitutional rights as well, by the way. And the fact that this case was thrown out, the fact that Scooter Libby walked, the fact that no one may go to jail, no one will be held accountable for outing a covert CIA operative because George Bush wanted to have his damn war, well, kind of pisses me off. And right now, as far as any recourse that the Wilsons, Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson, may have, it looks like they may have run out of options with the Supreme Court telling them to get lost. I hope to talk to Melanie Sloan later in the week from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington almost sounds oxymoronic right around now. Anyway, we'll try to get some more information from her. I spoke briefly via email with Joe Wilson this afternoon, and he is referring all comments to her for the time being. George Bush's father, by the way, had mentioned, what was it that he said about folks who would out our CIA operatives, that they are the most insidious of traitors? Talking to you, Dick Cheney. Talking to you, Scooter Libby. Talking to you, George W. Bush. And all those folks who didn't give a damn when we outed a covert CIA operative. Not just any CIA operative, but a knock. What do they call it? Non-official, yeah, woman under non-official cover. The kind of woman who, had she been caught in a foreign country, had her cover been blown in a foreign country, this nation would have said, oh, we never heard of her. She would have been killed. We would have never fought for her. Put me in a good mood, hasn't it? Supreme Court, some slightly better news here from the Supreme Court today. They ruled 8-1. 8-1. The only dissenter? Any idea who the only dissenter was on this? This is the voting rights case. And actually, we're going to have to take a break shortly, so I'm going to have to get into this a little bit later. But the good news is the Voting Rights Act suit, the lawsuit to essentially gut the Voting Rights Act, the essential provision that required states that have a history of disenfranchisement of minorities. They were trying to gut that, basically, and get rid of that provision, saying, well, it's 40 years later now. Racism is over. We've got Barack Obama in the White House. Everything is fine. We can get rid of the Voting Rights Act now. Well, thankfully, the Supreme Court disagreed in that 8-1 ruling. Oddly enough, Clarence Thomas dissented. Yeah, I know. So he wants to get rid of that. I guess he thinks that everything's fine. There's no racial injustice in this country anymore. They did, however, make a narrow ruling that the town, the water district that had brought this case to the Supreme Court, that they would be given some preference in reconsidering whether they have to be cleared, get pre-clearance from the federal government before they change their election laws. This is meant to protect people. This is meant to protect democracy. And for all the folks who are in D.C. right now, yelling and screaming and making noise about Iran, that they're concerned about democracy in Iran. Where the hell were they in 2000? Where the hell were they in 2004? And how is it that they allowed this case to even get this far to the Supreme Court for the Voting Rights Act? Luckily, the Supreme Court stood in the way. We're going to talk more about Iran after we come back from this break. Tony, okay? We in good shape now? You feel better? Okay. Everything's going to be all right, my friend. You're listening to Brad Friedman on the Mike Malloy Show. Much, much more straight ahead. And Tony's going to go mop the sweat off his brow. What could possibly go wrong from here? Brad Friedman, back in a minute. Welcome to the Highway to Hell. Brad Friedman in for Malloy all week long. What could possibly go wrong? Glad you're with us here. Coming up, Stephen Zunis at the bottom of the hour going to talk about what's going on in Iran. We're trying to keep our eyes on the D.C. situation where six have been killed in a metro train collision. But you know what's been going through my head all weekend long as I've been watching these wingnuts? And believe me, I'd be happy to beat up on Democrats all week long. They deserve it. And guess what? We're going to. But the fact of the matter is, watching these Republicans, we've got this thing exploding in Iran. And you've got a Republican Party that is so damn desperate to find anything that they can use against Barack Obama that they're willing to. I could not believe what happened to the idea that foreign policy on these sort of issues, sensitive issues, the disagreements stop at the water's edge, that we get behind the president. Now, the president has been very measured, as far as I'm concerned, in his response to Iran. No, he has not been timid. And I realize CNN and Fox and MSNBC that you don't have reporters out there in Iran, in Tehran, so you've got to find something to talk about. And no, I don't want to hear about Twitter. So you've got to come up with something. What are you going to come up with? Oh, Republicans, they're criticizing Barack Obama. He's not strong enough. Can I run this clip, Tony? This is over the weekend. Lindsey Graham and John McCain. This is just a sample. I mean, we heard this from a lot of them. Here's what they had to say about Obama as he's dealing with this crisis.
There's a monumental event going on in Iran, and you know the president of the United States is supposed to lead the free world, not follow it.
And again, it's not so much about Iran, although it certainly is at the moment, but it's also about being on the right side of history.
No, John McCain. Well, John, it's about you trying to get... You were on the wrong side of history. You lost the election, my friend. Here's what Obama had to say on Saturday. 4:15 p.m. on Saturday. Obama said, issued this statement, "The Iranian government must understand that the world is watching. We mourn each and every innocent life that is lost. We call on the Iran government to stop all violent and unjust actions against its own people. The universal rights to assembly and free speech must be respected, and the United States stands with all who seek to exercise those rights." As I said in Cairo, he goes on, "Suppressing ideas never succeeds in making them go away. The Iranian people will ultimately judge the action of their own government. If the Iranian government seeks the respect of the international community, it must respect the dignity of its own people and govern through consent, not coercion." I think that was pretty damn clear. I think it was pretty damn strong. I think it was appropriate. What it is that John McCain wants and Lindsey Graham wants? Do they want... What is with these? Are they suggesting that we should bomb these people? We've got enough. Don't we have enough going on? Don't we've got two wars? You know, an explosion went off in Iraq over the weekend, killing 33. There was an attack on the Bagram Air Force Base in airport in Afghanistan. Two people are dead. Two troops are dead. And these guys apparently want us to go to a war with Iran? Are you kidding?
It's well documented that we have, for quite a long time now, known where the real problem is in the Middle East. And, in fact, the president adequately described it as the axis of evil. I guess my question is, how many times do we have to prove that these people are blowing up people now, never mind if they get a nuclear weapon? When do we send them an airmail message to Tehran? That old Beach Boys song, Bomb Iran. Bomb, bomb, bomb. Anyway.
That's hysterical. John McCain singing Bomb, Bomb Iran in 2008 when he's running for president. Is that the kind of presidential behavior we should expect from you, Senator McCain? The guy who wanted to bomb these people, the very people who are out there in the streets, you wanted to bomb them last year? You and your party in 2007, and now you're upset that Barack Obama is not being tough enough. You need another war, Senator McCain? I think we've had quite enough of that. On this one, I'll support the president. 27 after, Brad Friedman in for Malloy all night long. Stephen Zunis right after this.
Cannon through the bathroom window. Can't you buy a silver spoon? But now she sucks up the
There we go. Welcome back. 34 minutes after the hour. Brad Friedman in for Malloy, who's on vacation all this week somewhere in the wilds of Florida, so I'm told. Give us a call if you'd like to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about that for the rest of this half hour here. And, of course, I was ranting how ticked off I am at the Republicans using this as an opportunity. The opportunism is incredible. The depths to which these guys will sink right now at a time of crisis like this is rather extraordinary. So give us a call if you like. 877-520-1150. That's different than Malloy's usual numbers. Don't call him. Call us. 877-520-1150. I'm joined by Stephen Zunis, the professor of politics and the chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. I've been following his work, his commentary on Iran over at the Huffington Post over the last couple of days. Welcome to the Malloy Show, Professor. Oh, there we go. Welcome to the Malloy Show, Professor.
Hey, great to be on.
All right, great to have you. Let me ask you, do you have contacts? Are you learning this just like we are from the media, from the Twitter? Or are you able to speak to anyone inside Iran to get a picture of what's actually going on out there?
I haven't spoken directly to people in Iran, though I've been in contact with people who have been.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty crazy. It's on the one hand, it's real exciting because people are mobilized to the degree that they are, you know, going out in the streets and everything. But it hasn't been much coordination. I mean, any struggle that you're in, whether it be an armed revolution and a war, or whether it be a nonviolent struggle like this has largely been, or a regular political campaign, whatever, it needs to be strategic. You need to really think step by step. This seems to be mostly spontaneous, and you know they've done some remarkable things. Really, shook things up quite a bit. But there's also kind of figuring out, well, what's next? What do we do now? How can we sustain this? How can we translate this popular anger into real change?
Now, you wrote recently at Huffington Post. You sort of gave us a great history of the history of civil insurrections, as you called it, going back like 100 years or so in Iran, where we have these cycles of popular uprisings, revolutions. How is what we are looking at out there in Iran today, how is that similar to some of these uprisings in the past, and how is this one different?
Well, it's similar in a lot of ways in that there's the idea of these massive demonstrations, strikes, the popular contestation of public space, who runs the streets. And this has been going back for over a century. I mean, the late 1800s, the tobacco strike and other strikes against the concessions given to British interests by the Shah of that era. There's a constitutional revolution about 100 years ago that forced the absolute monarch to allow for a parliament, to more of a constitutional monarch.
And is this how power traditionally changes in Iran? It comes to these sorts of uprisings?
Well, traditionally it's been handed down in the monarchy, if you go back far enough. But there has certainly been, in the modern history, this has been a major tool. Of course, one of the nastiest transitions, there are a couple of them. One was a British-backed coup in the mid-1920s, where they got the semi-literate army sergeant who was friendly with British interest and made him the new Shah. And then when his son was temporarily driven out by by more democratic forces, of course the U.S. Brought him back in a coup in 1953. And so one of the ironies about people talking about We've always supported democracy and freedom in Iran, as George W. Bush once said. It was that the last actual democratic government that country had, the CIA overthrew.
Right.
We kept put the Shah in power and kept him in power for a good quarter century. We armed and trained the Sabak, his dreaded secret police. He was pro-American, but a real tyrant. And he was so effective at crushing the democratic and secular and leftist and moderate resistance. And when they finally had the revolution, it came out of the one place Sabak couldn't totally penetrate, and that was the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a very strong anti-American and kind of fundamentalist overtone. And while the revolution itself was broad-based, where it was largely nonviolent, like we've been seeing today, only even bigger, with millions of people out on the streets and strikes and all that kind of thing, there was this power struggle in the ensuing months. And so within 18 months of the success of the revolution, some real hardliners ended up taking over and have more or less remained in charge ever since.
And that's why I'm struck by the tone I'm hearing out of D.C. and these people who are, calling on Obama to do more. I mean, he came out, 2 weeks ago in Cairo, really for the first time, outright acknowledged the role that the U.S. played in the coup back in 1953, and seemed to be making amends for that, if you will. And it seems as if these guys now want him to turn around and do the same thing and intercede into this country's struggles, whatever they may be. That's amazing to me. Now, that said, I've been hearing from people all week since the election saying, can't you tell, Brad, this is a CIA job from the get-go. Ahmadinejad, he was going to win. He did win. Everything was fine. And, of course, I've argued that we have no idea. It's speculation either side because, guess what? The ballots were counted in secret. So we, in truth, have no idea who won and who lost. But they're suggesting that this entire thing is a CIA, an intelligence operation.
And that's really silly. I mean, in 1953, Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, our CIA spook there, bribed some leaders in South Tehran to get a mob to start rioting. That was a few thousand. That wasn't the hundreds of thousands that came out. And it wasn't the riots that brought down Mossadegh. It was a military push that took place around that time. The riot was one of many efforts of a destabilization. So there's no comparison.
And
the CIA can certainly stage coups and do that kind of thing, but they can't organize a popular uprising. For one thing, I mean, it's kind of like saying that, it's like Reagan saying, the revolutions in Central America were part of a Soviet hit list, and it was all hatched in Moscow. It had nothing to do with the exploitation of the peasants and oppression of people there. It was all this plot in Moscow. I mean, it's just a silly story.
Okay, well, but let me push you a little bit harder on that. Speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco, let me push you a little harder on that. Yes, I agree. The people we're seeing in the streets, the hundreds of thousands, the millions, obviously these were not organized by the government. But is it not possible that whether it's U.S. intelligence services, British intelligence services, anybody, that they essentially set up the conditions for this to happen? I remember leading into this election about 2 weeks ago, people were already talking in the media, there's concerns it's going to be rigged, and there's been a popular uprising for Mousavi. Is it not possible that our intelligence agencies helped to create the conditions that when Ahmadinejad won, that suddenly this would cause the folks to say, wait a minute, no, this is something has gone wrong, and lead them out into the streets?
I doubt that, simply because there's a universal assumption, even by those of us who are very critical of U.S. policy, and
most
people who know about Iran are very critical of U.S. policy, that Ahmadinejad would lose. His slate has lost the recent municipal elections. His popularity was plummeting because, despite his populist rhetoric, his economic policies have been a disaster for the poor. He was particularly unpopular among younger people, among women, urban dwellers. His only base of support left, really, was in the rural areas, and that was less than 30% of the vote. And there are a whole bunch of things around the election, the stunning uniformity of Ahmadinejad's alleged margins, when elections historically in Iran have varied considerably by mm-hmm. ethnicity and region. The fact that the results were announced just a few hours after the polls closed, when in a country of 70 million using paper ballots, the secrecy of the whole thing, the leaks from the Interior Ministry of widespread malfeasance, the fact that despite that outlier poll that's been widely quoted, there are quite a number of other polls that indicated the elections was going against Ahmadinejad. I mean, there are a whole number of legitimate reasons to question. Again, I can't say solidly one way or another, but this is something that, this is not just CIA people raising doubts. I think there are doubts all around.
And I hear you. Let me bring in a caller here, if I can work this board here. Let me bring in Randy from Branson, Missouri. Randy, do I have you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. It sounds like you may, and I was going to say agree with me, but not agree with me. I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. I don't really have a position on this. You feel that the results were reflected, what, in that pre-election poll?
Well, yeah, I had heard no play in the media, but there was a guest editorial in the Washington Post about a week ago by some democracy monitoring organization that explained their polling methods. They said, we did pre-election polling, and the election tracked almost exactly to what their polling showed on their telephone polls. And I heard that give zero play. There's not a person out there in the corporate media or any media saying, maybe it was on the up and up. Did you know anything about that? Did you read that?
I saw the poll when it first came out, actually. And it was met by derision by a lot of us who were concerned about some of their methodology. Also, I read the op-ed in the Post, and it did get a fair amount of circulation, actually. What made me question was that if you actually read the analysis of the poll at the time it came out, it said that the margins are probably going to be less than what they predicted back a month ago, and in fact it ended up being a lot more. It also said that it was unlikely that either candidate would get a majority, and ends up that they claimed that Ahmadinejad got two-thirds of it. So in fact that very op-ed contradicts some of the findings of the very poll that it quotes, and as I, it's kind of an outlier poll. But let me get back to what you're implying and mentioning about sort of the opportunity for Republicans, because the Republicans 2 days before the election introduced a couple of resolutions in both houses of Congress that would have strengthened sanctions on Iran just before the election, when the reformists were supposed to win, in an apparent effort to create a nationalist reaction where Ahmadinejad would win. Daniel Pipes and these leading neocons were going around saying that, hey, we prefer Ahmadinejad because he is more obvious an enemy, and the trouble with most of me is that he's not really that much different.
But he's going to be
harder to be the enemy we love to hate. Harder to be the guy we can attack and use to undermine Obama's policies of rapprochement.
Yeah, that's one of the problems. Speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis, hang on through this break, Professor. I want to bring in some more of these calls. Yeah, that's one of the problems with this theory that it was the U.S. who's trying to topple these guys, when you had on the other side all of these right-wingers who preferred Ahmadinejad.
Exactly.
Of course, they might not have been talking and working out their plan, keeping their story straight with the intelligence agencies. But who knows? I tend to be with you, Professor. We're going to take a quick break here. Brad Friedman in for Malloy on the Mike Malloy Show. More of your calls and Stephen Zunis right after this break. All right.
You better get your
Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com in for Malloy all week. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis, Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at University of San Francisco, about developments in Iran. I want to try to get a bunch of your calls here if I can before we go to the top of the hour. But quickly, Professor, you had mentioned the 1979 revolution went on for, you say, 18 months before the government finally toppled?
Do you see
that happening? Can these guys hang in there that long, or does this go another way?
It could go in any way. I mean, it could escalate dramatically in the next few days and weeks, and throughout the hardliners in short order. It could be crushed only to come back 3, 5, 10 years down the road, like with Solidarity in Poland. Or it could be something that indeed goes on for a year and a half or more as in waves, as it did in Iran 30 years ago.
And predictions at this point make no sense because we're all just guessing.
I really don't dare, but what I can say for fairly confident is the day that the hardliners are thrown out is closer as a result of the events of the past week. How much closer, I don't know, but definitely closer.
All right, let's go to Amir in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Amir, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brad, how are you doing? Hello, Professor. I want to make a couple of points here. First, as far as the revolution of 1979 is concerned, my family was there in 1979, and if the professor can attest to this, the protests and demonstrations in the streets went one continuous chain, like weeks on end, and then basically another one would start up. What happened is the first one started because in Qom, which is the holy city of Iran, there was about 80 people protesting the Shah in early 1978. There was a confrontation between the police and those students, those basically religious students that were protesting. 5 or 6 of them got killed. 40 days later in Tabriz, 40 days there was nothing going on. 40 days later in the city of Tabriz, there was a memorial service held for those students where there was another demonstration. What happened? Police came out again. There was a slaughter again. And then 40 days later in Tehran, same thing, and then it just continued until it snowballed and it built up. So I'm not surprised that things are dying down on the streets, because you'll be surprised. All of a sudden, the next week there's going to be a general strike,
which is what we saw in 1979, Professor, wasn't that made the difference, those strikes?
That's why I mentioned waves of protests, because traditionally in Shia Islam there is this 40-day mourning period, and after those 40 days people come out en masse and there'd be massacres, and then again 40 days later, and already while the shootings have not been as widespread as they've been during much of the revolution's Shah, there have been people dead. Now we have the advantage, of course, of YouTube, where millions of people have seen the shocking shooting of that young woman, and who's being declared a martyr, which is again very, very important designation in Shia Islam. And it's interesting, the protesters now are using some of the same imagery, the color green, which is the color of Islam, which was big in 78, 79. They're using it now. The shouting of Allahu Akbar, God is great, from the rooftops. That was a similar tactic used back then. The rallying sites, not just in Tehran, but in Isfahan, Tabriz, around the country, same rallying sites they did then. So they're clearly trying to emulate the revolution of 30 years ago.
All right, thanks for that call. Yeah, you can make it in 10 seconds, Amir. Sorry.
Look, Randy, I got to tell you something. That poll, it was faulty as hell. First of all, nobody in Iran, when they get on the phone, they're going to tell you the truth that they hate the government. It's a dictatorship, they'll slit your throat. Second of all, what's going on is, it's like comparing a poll that was taken on September 10th that McCain and Palin were up by 5 points, and then if they would have rigged it and won the election by 5 points, and then saying, ooh, look, this poll that was taken on September 10th is exactly the same result as the November 4th election.
Thanks for your call, Amir. I appreciate it. I gotta get out for the top of the hour. I do appreciate that call, and I hope your family stays safe out in Tehran. All right, Professor, yeah, we're going to have to cut this short, I'm sorry to say, but we may have you back throughout the week as things move forward in Tehran. It is a mess out there. Professor Stephen Zunis, Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. You can get more information on him at stephenzunis.org. That's STEPHENZUNIS. www.ss.org. Thank you, Professor, and please stay in close touch over this next week.
I'd like that.
Appreciate it. All right, when we come back, well, I was going to say we're going to turn the page a little bit. Going to bring in Eric Bullard from MediaMatters.org, although I suspect he has some thoughts on the way the media has been covering Iran. And so those folks who wish to stay online, if you want, stay in there. If I can get your calls in, I certainly will. Eric Bullard for Media Matters, his new book, The Bloggers on the Bus, all of that, and much more straight ahead on The Mike Malloy Show. Brad Friedman in for Mike.